Welcome! Once again, you are here with your host. That's me, Holly. And together, we are at the second location, where I am continuing our discussion of the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. And in this episode, I will talk about Mike Scott's trial and both of the convicted men's appeals. Now, with Rob's case decided, and with Rob on death row, the state readies itself for the prosecution of the second charged defendant, Michael Scott. Unlike in Rob's trial, where the prosecution's first witness was Bob Ayers, that's Amy's father, and he described his little girl as a cowgirl, and just gave all this beautiful detail to Amy's life, and I think the defense was expecting that same tactic, with going with a family member to establish who the victim was first. But that's not what they do at Mike Scott's trial. Instead, the state's first witness was used to enter Mike's confession into evidence. So they're starting with his confession. And the defense, they just, honestly, they weren't properly prepared, it seems like, to confront the confession at this point in the trial. And the cross-examination was long, and I've heard it described as lacking direction, and that makes some sense, because it's meandering a bit at times. But they did do a great job pointing out the differences between the recordings of the interviews of Mike that were made by the police and Mike's written confession. So the interrogation and the written confession, there's a lot of differences between those. And the defense does a really good job hammering those home. And these inconsistencies should have had more sway with the jury. Because if these confessions were honestly voluntary, valid, truthful confessions, there shouldn't be large differences between the oral and written confession. In my opinion, the defense should have been a little bit more prepared, as they had more time than Rob's team to prepare a defense. But then again, Mike's lead attorney came late to the case, as the first lead attorney was that guy who mainly did civil cases and was just coming off of a bar suspension. So I have different feelings about this, because I think Mike's case was definitely winnable, more so perhaps than Rob's. But also, I really don't like this lawyer who doesn't seem to do these big capital murder cases, thinking, I'll just change from being a civil litigator to a criminal defense attorney on a case like this. You're dealing with somebody's life. It isn't the time to try new shit. But anyway, like I said, Mike's lead attorney came to the case late, and he was the one that really needed to get up to speed, because he was the one that was really going to be in charge of the trial. And even though Mike's defense team had so much more time to prepare than Rob's, and they got to see the Rob's trial as a basic, you know, a template of what would happen for Mike's trial, I just think that this senior lawyer came on late. The other lawyer, I don't know if he really had any business being on the case in the first place. At least not his first chair, I'll put it that way. Okay, now let me highlight some of the many statements in Mike's police interrogation, the interview, that didn't match up with the evidence at the crime scene, including Mike's repeated claim that all four girls were shot as they stood behind the counter. Mike never wavered from that. He believes that the girls were all shot in the front room of the yogurt shop, when in fact they were all murdered in the back room. Mike also claimed that he shot one girl in the face, and actually no one was shot in the face. All the shots were to the back of the girls' heads. Mike didn't know initially that the girls were shot. He didn't know how they were killed. He didn't know that one girl was shot twice, gagged, what they were bound with, or the types of guns that were used, until the police supplied this information to him. And Mike claimed that the girls' feet were bound, and they weren't. So just listen to that. He thinks everybody's killed out in the front of the yogurt shop. That's wrong. He thinks one girl was shot in the face. That's incorrect. He initially didn't even know that the cause of death was a gunshot. He didn't know that Amy was shot twice. He didn't know about the gags. He didn't know what they were bound with. And he didn't know what types of guns were used. And he thought the girls' feet were bound, and they weren't. This is not a police interview with responses from a suspect that makes me think that this guy was there when this crime was committed. He seems to know very little about the actual crime. Now, Mike also claimed that napkins and styrofoam cups were piled on top of the girls' bodies, which were then doused with lighter fluid, and a Zippo lighter was used to start the fire. But you have to recall that all three of the original arson investigators had determined that the fire started on a shelving unit in the back room. But like I said in the last episode, the fire investigators changed their tune, and it seems they did this rather reluctantly after hearing Mike's confession about starting the fire on the girls' bodies. Now, during cross-examination, the defense did an excellent job with the original fire investigator, getting him to admit that he originally thought that the fire originated on the shelves, and that he maintained that belief until after Mike's confession. The fire investigator more or less admitted that he only changed his opinion when the state had found a fire expert from the ATF who had made a determination based on software analysis of the fire that was in agreement with Mike's confession. Even then, the original fire investigator initially refused to change his opinion. It was only after meeting twice with this new fire investigator from the ATF that the OG guy that was at the crime scene became convinced that the fire didn't start on the shelves. So far in the trial, we have Mike's confession introduced into evidence, and we have the testimony of the arson investigator. After this, the prosecution called various other witnesses, many of whom had been called at Rob's trial. One witness stood out to me. It was a boy that alleged that Maurice Pierce had bought a .22 from him. But this .22 that Maurice had in his possession at the mall when he was picked up with that .22 about a week after the murders, that is presumably the gun that this kid sold to Maurice. Now, side note, this tells you what a sleaze Maurice is. Maurice buys this .22 from a classmate, and he refuses to pay for it. So I guess it's more of a stolen situation? It just tells you who we're dealing with here. But anyway, that .22 that this kid testifies that he had, you know, sold or tried to sell to Maurice, but Maurice ended up with possession of the gun? That's the gun that was repeatedly tested. And it was clear that it was not the murder weapon. So this testimony, to me, doesn't even seem relevant to this trial. Does it matter that one of the boys had a .22 if it wasn't the murder weapon? To me, it doesn't. I just don't know why this even came in at trial, honestly. If you think about that, how many people in Texas would have owned a .22? I don't know. I'm going to say just about everybody. I mean, a .22, that is about as common as you get for caliber, you know? So I don't think that's persuasive. And we have that gun. The gun that the kid sold was actually his father's gun. So I think it could be definitively determined if that was the gun that the police had that Maurice, you know, was caught with. And then once it doesn't match, who cares that this kid sold Maurice a .22. If it's not the murder weapon, it's not relevant to this trial, and it's not relevant to this crime. It's muddying the waters, and I don't like it.
A detective was then called to read a condensed version of Rob Springsteen's confession. Once again, it was redacted in the same way that Mike's confession had been altered for the previous trial. And the defense, of course, objected to the omission of Rob's confession, but, of course, they were overruled. Then the prosecution rested its case. So, of course, up next is the defense, and they focused their case mainly on the police's failure to properly investigate the murders. You know, just overall trying to paint the case as bungled and mismanaged, and honestly, it's a pretty accurate assessment. The defense's first witnesses were firefighters, who outlined how they had let slip details of the crime scene to their wives and other firefighters, and this is how it was partially established that so many of these details that had been holdback information had actually gotten out to the public. So now we know that some of that information was well known to the public early on in the investigation. And honestly, firefighters, I'm really disappointed. I mean, you guys are the only guys I ever want to see with an axe. And then you just blab super secret crime scene information to your wives. Dudes, do better. This stuff needs to be a secret for a reason. And I mean, I don't know, should the firefighters need to be told, don't tell people everything you saw there today? But I get it. This scene was hard to process emotionally. But man, see a therapist that is bound by confidentiality rules, or at least don't marry loose-lipped women. But the volume of information that got out in this case is just tremendous. At the end of the day, I think there's almost no holdback information. While many of the witnesses were the same in both Rob and Mike's trials, you know, mainly really only the order of witnesses really differed, but one witness varied from Rob's earlier trial. There was a police officer that was a witness to Mike's written confession. When the police officer testified, he was asked to describe a cross that's affiliated with a prison gang called the Texas Syndicate, and a mark is made over the cross to signify each term in prison that one serves. Okay, let that sink in, because I had never heard that before, and it was never mentioned at the previous trial, the first trial for Rob, but somewhere at that crime scene, there has to be a cross drawn in what? I don't know. But it was related to a prison gang. The police did manage to hold back one piece of information, I guess. But I will circle back to this later when I discuss the type of person that I think could have committed these crimes. But that's important to know. In this one small bit of little testimony there of someone that's just a witness to the written confession, he's describing something that none of us had heard of. A cross is at the crime scene that's affiliated with a prison gang. And keep in mind that none of the accused, these four young guys, none of them have ever been to prison before they were accused of this quadruple murder. Now, once again, just like in Rob's trial, only two of the other 50 confessions were admitted into evidence. The defense was desperately trying to show that Mike had learned the few correct details that were in his confession because there were rumors that just about everybody in Austin knew, rumors that happened to be accurate. The defense planned to call both an expert on false confessions and a memory expert, but the judge really limited the scope of their testimony. And the scope was so limited on the false confession testimony that the defense decided not to even call that expert. Which I think was a mistake. I mean, some testimony about false confessions is better than none, but you hate it when the judge thinks he's part of the prosecution team, you know what I mean? Because this is bad. You're not leaving the defense with many options to actually be able to defend their client. The defense had another expert to call, a crime scene reconstructionist named Ross Martin Gardner. This guy is absolutely amazing, and he used logic to try and recreate the events of that night. Absolutely everything that he testified to makes absolute sense to me, and he seems like the only person who was able to reconstruct what happened that night. Gardner found that the evidence indicated that the shop had already been shut down before the killers approached the girls, because one girl had started cleaning the large yogurt dispensers. Those were being emptied, so the shop was in its closing process. They were not accepting any more customers at this point. They're emptying out the yogurt. As she's cleaning out that yogurt dispenser, that's when the attack starts. Gardner noted that the yogurt shop's phone was found off the hook, and yet phone records showed that no calls were made after the shop closed. So here's what we're thinking. Either one of the girls grabbed that phone in an attempt to call for help, to call 911, and the receiver was taken from her, or the killers had simply taken the phone off of the hook as it was found dangling from its cord when the fire was put out. Now, the police did not retain this phone, and I don't know if it was dusted for prints, or if it was even possible to be dusted for prints because it was damaged in the fire. But that telephone was not retained as evidence, and its current location is not known. There's a very good chance that one of the killers touched that phone, either when they took it out of one of the girls' hands, or when they took it off the hook themselves. But that phone's value as a piece of evidence is lost. Now, Gardner theorizes that after being confronted with their attackers, the girls, most likely right now it's only Eliza and Jennifer that are in the front of the part of the shop. The two older girls are actually the workers, while Amy and Sarah are in the back. These two older girls are rushed to that back room, you know, where Sarah and Amy were already cleaning up back there. And all the girls were forced to undress at this point. Now, it's a slow process somewhat, as each girl's clothes are nicely folded into individual little stacks. And Jennifer even removed the ring her boyfriend had given her. It seems that the girls were complying because the clothes are not torn and no buttons are missing. And they're folded, so it looks like the girls probably took their clothes off themselves. But they're complying because they're being forced to comply. There are stabbing-like cuts in some pieces of the clothing. So that's why the girls did. Some of the girls were being stabbed. The clothes and shoes were found in little individual stacks near the back door. So this is likely where they were forced to disrobe, in that back room. Now, three of the girls are then gagged with items of their clothing. Only Amy is not gagged. Two girls, Sarah and Eliza, are bound. Not their feet, just bound at the wrist. Leading Gardner to think that the gags were placed on the three girls first, and then the process of binding the girls' arms began. So right now we have three of the girls are gagged. Only Amy's not gagged. And Sarah and Eliza, their arms are tied behind their backs. Now, according to Gardner, the pulling of blood and the angle of the bullet wounds show that Sarah, Eliza, and Jennifer were face down on the floor when they were shot in the back of the head. And I think this testimony right here was really the first time that the events of that night were ever outlined for the public in a way that truly made sense and utilized the evidence at the scene to tell the story. And that's really sad because this is the second defendant to go on trial. I don't think this was laid out like this before. Now, the next expert was Gardner's partner, Tom Bevel. Bevel had originally been contacted by the prosecution, and when Bevel gave them his final report, after reviewing the report that this expert complied, the prosecution chose not to call Bevel as a witness, since it didn't fit with their theory of Rob and Mike's guilt. So when the defense sees this, the defense calls Bevel as a witness, and they use this to try to show that the prosecution wasn't after the truth, and that any evidence that went against their theory of the crime was excluded. And that really seems like it's the case. So instead of ending on a high note, the last day of the defense's case was a mishmash of witnesses, including Mike's Boy Scout leader. Now, he testified that the day after the murders, Mike attended a Boy Scout meeting where he acted like the regular good old Mike, nothing out of the normal, you know, just Mike, and after these witnesses, the defense requested more time. Remember that Mike's chief attorney was appointed after the Springsteen trial, and he wanted more time to prepare. But like Rob's team had wanted more time, both times, for Rob and for Mike, the judge denied these requests. The defense request for a continuance was denied, and closing arguments would begin promptly. I think asking for a continuance after the trial has begun, I think that's very unusual, but it really speaks to the level of desperation to this case. And as I'm reading over what I wrote, I never fully remembered until right now reading my notes that Mike's chief attorney wasn't assigned to this case until after Rob's trial had been completed. So he really didn't have much time to prepare. I mean, gosh, they really made a mistake going with that civil litigator to try this murder case. So after the defense's request for a continuance is denied, it's time for closing arguments. And of course, the prosecution goes first. And once again, it was competent but not memorable. Not only was the prosecution argument less passionate, but a crucial mistake was made when the prosecutors told the jury if there were doubts or questions about guilt, the jurors should compare the confessions of Rob and Mike and note the similarities between the two. The prosecution also asserted that investigators had not suggested any answers to Rob, which we know is bullshit. Now, on closing, the defense fared much better, and the judge recalled that he thought this was one of the best closing arguments that he had ever heard. And I liked how the defense explained the testimony of the detectives in the case, and how they all just knew Mike was guilty, and how it was almost godlike that all these detectives could tell whether or not someone was lying. It does bother me that thinking someone is guilty is just so clearly an opinion, but police officers offer their opinions at trial in their testimony as fact. Why the hell are their opinions facts? Mine aren't. So I really did like that part of the closing, and I think I could see some more lawyers adopting because it was very effective, at least for me. Also really good was when he acknowledged that the families of the girls deserved answers, as did the city itself. I'm a little bit tired of that. The community deserves the answers. It's the family. The girls deserve justice. The family deserves the answers and justice. The community, I care a little bit less about. The community thing is kind of grates on me. You know, let's not piggyback on other people's grief. As I say that as I record a true crime podcast. But the jury shouldn't take the easy way out. Just because they wanted justice and answers, you can't take the easy way out and find an innocent man guilty as a means of wrapping up a case. It accomplishes nothing. You got innocent people in jail and killers roaming the streets. You didn't help, you hurt. The defense also emphasized the backdoor lock and how it was the defense team's belief that the killers entered through the front door or hid in the crawl space in the ceiling, and had to pry their way out of that back door. A theory completely inconsistent with Mike and Rob's confession that the back door had been propped open by one of them earlier so they could exit. But there was evidence at the crime scene that that door had been pried open. There were scratch and marks on it that looked like somebody had taken some type of tool, crowbar, something like that, I don't know what, and had forced that door. But once again, that lock wasn't preserved by the police. They really lost or failed to preserve a lot of evidence here. I mean, it's the ladder, the shelves, the lock, the phone, the table where the last customers were sitting. I mean, there's so much. Didn't fingerprint the bathrooms. So much wasn't done. But I want to go back to that lock and the theory that the killers exited through that back door and it hadn't been unlocked earlier in the night. It hadn't been propped open. And I'm talking about, I'm honest, I'll repeat this again later because this part gets me so much. Is I think those son of a bitches killed those girls, set that room on fire, and went to walk out that back door, not realizing that it was locked. And the key is on the opposite side of the shop. And what's between them and that key that's in the front door lock? A fire. Yeah, they locked themselves into a damn burning building. And it makes me seem like a mean person, but I just love to think that how scared those assholes were in those moments when they're panicking trying to get out of that goddamn back door. They were almost as scared as those girls were about 15 minutes earlier. So, sorry about that. That was like, bothers me. So, closing arguments, time for the jury to deliberate. And while deliberating, the first request of the jury was the photograph of the back door lock. And this gave the defense a little hope, because Mike's lawyer really thought that the back door lock was the linchpin of the case. And I don't know if it's a linchpin, but it's big. I'll say that. It is big. And here's what they had for evidence of that back door lock. The investigation here, I just can't. It's the worst. Wait, no, Delphi might be the worst, but this is like it's neck and neck. There was a single unclear picture of the back door lock that looked like it needed a key to be opened from the inside.
So when you're looking at the lock, the handle, there's a slot there. You're going to have to unlock that. It's a door that automatically locks. So you have to unlock it all the time, even to open it from the inside. And there were scratches along the door that made it look like the killers had to force open that door to flee, and that it had never been propped open. And you can see that in this single blurry picture. Now, both confessions had included the back door being propped open from the inside. Both Rob and Mike had said that. While this door was open earlier, someone went in there, propped open the door, and they came back later. If a key had been needed to open this door, they never would have been able to prop open that door from the inside. That wouldn't even have been possible, because if that door is a door that automatically locks and cannot be opened from the outside or the inside without a key, it doesn't matter if any of those young men went to that back room and tried to prop open that door, because they wouldn't have been able to do it, because none of them had a key. And that's huge. And I don't know if they brought that out clear at trial. Did they call other employees of that shop? Did they call the manager? Did anybody testify that that door, when it's closed, it locks from both the outside and the inside? You need a key to open it from both the outside and the inside. I don't think that happened. Or at least it wasn't clear. But everyone that looks at that lock says, that's the type of lock it is. So it's very confusing. I mean, I think there's some testimony that should have been made here, but they didn't retain the lock. If they retained the lock off the door, you'd be able to tell. You'd be able to use it. Now, let me calm down here a bit and regroup. You'd be able to contact the manufacturer and find out information about it. But they didn't keep it. Oh. So there's 22 hours of deliberations, and the jury returns a guilty verdict. So now, during the sentencing phase, the prosecution called witnesses that were former friends of Mike. And I use friends here loosely, maybe acquaintances might be the better term, to testify for the prosecution, because these witnesses, they testify that Mike's youthful boasts of being a mushroom king, claiming to earn hundreds of thousands of dollars, well, the witnesses admitted that while Mike made these claims, they really all thought he was just making it up. Another woman testified, and she described a, quote, hollering match that she had with Mike in a store. And a jail guard testified to Mike having contraband that had never been reported. So I guess a jail infraction should get you the death penalty, even if that jail infraction has not been documented in any way. That's a reach, okay? Overall, I'm just going to say it was pretty flimsy shit. I mean, a woman you got into a hollering match with at a grocery store? I mean, that's determining what your sentence should be in a quadruple murder? I don't even know what to say to that. It's just not strong evidence, let's put it that way. But what they did have that was good was Bob Ayers, because he once again, he gave moving testimony about his little girl, Amy. But unlike Rob's trial, where Rob had no mitigating evidence admitted during the sentencing phase, Mike's defense team decides to present mitigating factors. You know, he's trying to avoid the death penalty here. Mike's wife testified about what a good father he was, and Mike's dad talked about him, you know, making that Native American clothing as a Boy Scout, and fellow medieval reenactors also testified on his behalf. I mean, Mike seems like he might be a little bit of a character, but he has people that are willing to come forward for him and support him, and he comes off sounding to me like a goofball, but not at all like a killer. Now, the law in Texas at that time was that anyone under 17 at the time of the crime was committed was not eligible for the death penalty, while all crimes 17 and above could receive the death penalty. You know, Mike's 17, so we got 17 and above in Texas, you could get death. Now, the defense calls an expert who testified during the sentencing phase that executing people that were under 18 at the time of their crimes violated the Eighth Amendment prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. Now keep in mind, just a few years after the trial, the Supreme Court will decide the same thing, and all death sentences for those under 18 at the time of their crimes will be overturned, and those people will have to be resentenced. On this issue, the defense requested a directed verdict, which would have meant that the judge himself would remove the death penalty as a punishment, but that motion was overruled. After 3 hours of deliberations, the jury returned, and Mike was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum sentence of 35 years. The families of the girls were disappointed, while Mike's family finally had a reason to have some hope. He wasn't going to be executed, and there was a good chance that he might live to see a life outside of prison. Now, with two convictions obtained, the prosecution turned to the third and final person that they had been able to obtain an indictment against. That's the supposed ringleader, Maurice Pierce. And a trial date in April of 2003
was set. But in January of 2003, just 4 months before trial was set, all charges against Maurice were dropped. The only witnesses they had that could have connected Maurice to the murders were Rob and Mike, and they both refused to testify against Maurice. And under the Fifth Amendment, their right to not incriminate themselves, they couldn't be compelled. Now, because Maurice had managed to keep his mouth shut, he avoided prosecution. And the state implied that they were continuing the investigation and maybe, you know, they might prosecute additional defendants at a later time. But to this date, they never have. And after 3.5 years in jail, Maurice was released. The man was held for 3.5 years before trial. Jeez. Maurice returned to his wife, but he didn't leave Texas. But he should have. He really should have. And he might not have had the funds really to pick up and move. It's easy to say that people should move out of an area. Not as easy when you don't got the money to do it. But in Texas, he is always on the police's radar. And he was pretty much consistently pulled over. And he was, I mean, almost always in violation of a traffic law. And I don't know if this was partly because he was always in violation of a traffic law or because, you know, he didn't always have a ton of money, it doesn't seem. And he might have had cars that had some issues. And he's known to the police. When something is wrong with his vehicle, they are going to be on him. And that's what happens. As Mike and Rob proceeded through their appeal process, the U.S. Supreme Court would revisit the issue of hearsay statements in criminal cases and the strength and the purpose of the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment was restored in 2004, just a few years after the verdicts in the yogurt trials. In Crawford v. Washington, the Supreme Court replaced the earlier standard for admission for an out-of-court statement. The prior standard was that the statement bore adequate indicia of reliability. How lovely and how vague. Basically, your constitutional right to question those who bear witness against you is stripped away if the hearsay statement seems like it's reliable. What is the standard of reliability? It boiled down to whether the statement fit into one of these well-established exceptions to hearsay, or if it bore other established indicators of trustworthiness. In the yogurt shop case, the prosecutors stated that the co-defendant's confessions were reliable because they were giving voluntarily, and thus they were trustworthy. How the hell being voluntary goes to the truth of a statement is beyond me. And honestly, I would personally argue that these statements weren't voluntary, but you can voluntarily tell a lie just as easy as a person can voluntarily tell the truth. And it's bizarre to me because it's saying it should fit into one of the established exceptions of hearsay. And the statement's voluntariness is not an exception to hearsay. So it's not one of those, it's not one of the exceptions to hearsay, which is like excited utterance, statement of present conditions. Okay, those are some examples of exceptions to hearsay. But this doesn't fall into one of the exceptions to hearsay, so it has to have other indicators of trustworthiness. And the only one they got is the claim that they're voluntary. And these statements are not voluntary. So they got nothing, anyway, to show that these statements should have come in each confession against the other man. The voluntariness issue on this, is to me, is Rob's attorney was denied access to him while he's being questioned. So to me, that's saying Rob wasn't free to go. Rob was in custody. Rob should have been Mirandized before all this questioning happened. And he wasn't. So I think everything should be tossed based on that. I also think it's not voluntary because he doesn't know his rights at that point. He's not been told of his rights. Now, this is going to show you just how unfair the justice system is and how unequal it is. Because in 2006, Rob won an appeal and his conviction was reversed and remanded for retrial. And this reversal was based on the Confrontation Clause issue that Mike had just lost his appeal on. Now, isn't it weird one defendant gets a new trial on the same issue that another defendant in almost the exact same circumstances in the same state loses an appeal on? It just shows the arbitrariness of the judicial process. Well, with the remand for the retrial, the state requested a rehearing where the court would review its opinion, but this was denied. The state was going to have to retry Rob or dismiss the charges. I think at this point, everyone knew that Rob wasn't going to take a plea bargain. I mean, he refused one before, and the tide was finally turning in his favor. Now, it's the spring of 2007 when Mike's conviction was overturned on an appeal. And this is about a year after Rob's reversal. The judge from the original trials began to prepare for new trials. And unlike with the first two trials, the judge determined there would be no gag order. The prosecution protested, but it didn't work. And I think this is important. Gag orders frighten me in a way. But when only one side wants them, it's even more frightening because that side has something to hide. But in this case, with these new trials, with these retrials, the public was going to know what was going on in these trials. Unlike before, the state didn't know what to do. They had no real evidence against Rob, just his confession that he had recanted and that didn't line up with the evidence. And they could no longer use Mike's confession against him, so they were desperate for some real evidence. And so they submitted some biological material from the rape kits performed on the girls for DNA testing. And this would ultimately lead to freedom for both Mike and Rob, because the DNA recovered from the vaginal swabs taken from young Amy didn't match any of the four accused men. It didn't match Mike, Rob, Forrest, or Maurice. And this DNA testing had not been available when the girls were murdered in 1991. Science had advanced. It was a newer technology that tested solely for the male Y chromosome. It's referred to as a YSTR test, and it separates male DNA from samples that also contain female DNA. And this was a big advance in analyzing DNA that was recovered from a sexual assault, because the female DNA gets mixed in with the male DNA, and you have to get those two separated so you can analyze each individual's DNA separately. And because only men have the Y chromosome, you grab the Y strand, and you know what you're looking at. Now, in April of 2007, the DNA results are back, and the defense wanted to conduct tests on all four girls at a private lab. The prosecution resisted. The judge ordered that physical evidence be turned over to the defense. It was a lot of evidence, stuff that the defense should have had in the original trials, really, but I think the judge didn't want to make that same mistake again, so he had all the evidence turned over this time. The next day, Rob's lawyer requested that bond be set for his client. And I say, why the hell not? His conviction was overturned in 2006, where it's sitting in 2008, waiting for a retrial. Just got DNA results that showed that he wasn't implicated in the sexual assault, nor were any of his friends. So I say, it's time for bond. I mean, the crimes he is charged with are the absolute worst. But the only evidence against him is that weak-ass confession, and now he has DNA results to back him up. But the judge denied bond. So now, there is DNA, and it doesn't match any of the four men that the state had accused of rape, multiple murder, and an arson. An unnamed source from the prosecutor's office told a newspaper that the prosecutors may know the source of the DNA taken from Amy, and there is a suggestion, an implication, we'll say, that little 13-year-old Amy was sexually active at the time of her death, that perhaps the DNA was the result of consensual sex. And, this is appalling. She's 13 years old. There's no proof of this. I don't even think there's proof that she had a little boyfriend. The parents should never have had to have heard any of this bullshit. Because 4 months later, the prosecutors still haven't found the source of that DNA. And, you know, that they were so sure they knew where that DNA came from, even though the state had tested 63 potential sources of DNA. They have no clue who did this. And the state was constantly trying to delay the retrials. And it reminds you back to when the poor defense teams were both trying to get extensions for the original trials. State wasn't agreeing to that then, but now they want all the delays they can get. It's just such a stark contrast from those first two trials when the defense wanted more time and the prosecution just kept bulldozing forward. And I hate this. Buying time. It's not like 3 more weeks is going to give them some actual evidence. It's just stalling the inevitable. All the while, these men are in prison, and it's pitiful. So, defense got control of the physical evidence, and they submitted a lot of samples for DNA testing. And the results start to come back from the private labs, and it's eye-opening. The vaginal swabs from Sarah and Jennifer showed partial DNA profiles from an additional 2 to 3 unknown men. Right there. It's a different profiles from what was returned from Amy's swabs. So we know there are 3 to 4 men. We know that there are at least 3 to 4 men in that yogurt shop that committed these crimes. Now, Eliza's lower body was too damaged for this type of testing, but additional testing could potentially reveal additional DNA sources from the sample taken from Eliza. And I know what you're thinking, that's 4 unknown men. And I'm hoping the prosecution is not going to argue that these young girls all had consensual sex with 4 unknown males. And honestly, I think the state would have said that if it had been fewer males. But 4 is a lot, you know? This claim that all of these girls were sexually active, especially when one of them is 13. In 1991, even if she was, let's find the statutory rapist that did that, you know? Solve that crime. But anyway, We do know that Jennifer, she did have consensual sex with her known high school boyfriend, and the test showed this, but it was just too many unknown DNA profiles to really argue that these girls had consensual sex with these men. Yeah, it's too many unknowns. It's 3 to 4 unknowns. And let me explain the results a little and how the prosecution wasn't going to be able to get away with claiming it was all consensual sex. The male DNA profile found on Amy's slides was also found on Jennifer's slides. So that means Jennifer and Amy were both assaulted by the same person. And Jennifer, there was also male DNA of her boyfriend, Sammy. Sarah's slides revealed that there was a male DNA profile from Sammy and another unknown male DNA profile. So what we're seeing there on Sarah's slide is there was a male DNA profile from Sammy and also an unknown male DNA profile. So what happened there was one of the killers assaulted Jennifer. During that assault, he picked up some of Sammy's DNA from Jennifer's body. And then when he assaulted Sarah, he transferred some of Sammy's DNA to Sarah. And on the clothing used to bind Eliza, there was a third unknown male DNA profile. So with the part with Sammy's DNA turning up on both Jennifer and Sarah, I mean, the prosecutors can't act like this is consensual. Jennifer's not having consensual sex with her boyfriend and then some random dude. And then that random dude has sex with her little sister. You're not going to be able to argue that. Clearly, there was a sexual assault that happened in the back of that yogurt shop before the murders. After more delays by the prosecution, the judge released both men. By now, it's June of 2009. And just think of that. Rob's conviction was overturned in 2006. Mike's in 2007. It's not till 2009 that they are getting released. And it's largely because of these DNA results that the prosecution fought against having. The prosecution did not want all of these slides tested. It says a lot, very negatively, about the prosecution in this case. The convictions had been overturned in 2006 and 2007. The prosecution could no longer delay the trials and keep the men imprisoned. So they're out. By now, the state had tested 130 men looking for the source of unknown male DNA. They had no clue. No matter what they said, they had no idea who had raped and murdered these little girls. The girls' families still believed that the four accused men were guilty, and they were disappointed. And I will not criticize the families of the girls. They were lied to by people they trusted that should have been trustworthy. Law enforcement lied to them. Prosecutors lied to them. The state lied to them. They were misled. And when they keep pushing, even after DNA shows that these four young men were not related to this crime, and you keep pushing the narrative that they were, the state's being dishonest with these people. And I think that's truly sad. After facing the loss of a young child in such a brutal fashion, and then, you know, they have to go through a trial, and they believe that their child's killers has been punished. You know, it takes a unique person to realize that perhaps that was the wrong man all along. While I won't criticize the families, I will criticize the prosecution, because to this day, they still won't admit that they got the wrong guys. They blame contamination on the DNA testing results, but the results from the swabs from Amy's were done by the state lab. So are they actually saying that the state agency that they consistently rely on for DNA testing in all of their cases contaminated the results? And the police continued to assert with complete confidence that they had gotten the right guys. Honestly, it looks like the police are trying to argue that it was 7 to 8 people that came into the yogurt shop that night, and they just managed to arrest the 4 non-rapists. You would think that the guys that left genetic material would be easier to track down than the 4 guys that didn't. But you'd be wrong. The judge gave the prosecution until the end of October to be ready for trial. And after that, there could be no further delays. On October 28th of 2009, the deadline given by the judge to the prosecution, on that deadline, the prosecution announced that they were still conducting testing, and the judge dismissed the charges against both men. Without prejudice, so they could be charged again. Outside the courtroom, the defense team noted that this wasn't a victory, that hopefully the families would one day know who killed their daughters. And this is where I'm going to leave you. We have 4 young men that were arrested, 3 were indicted, and 2 were convicted. And then their convictions are reversed. So, next time we talk, we'll be about crime scene analysis. What type of person do we think would have committed a crime like this? Where's the science on this? Like, this DNA testing's advancing. Are we going to be able to find out one day who killed Eliza, Sarah, Jennifer, and Amy? because I think we will find out, and hopefully it'll be soon.